Today, the background of the creation-evolution controversy. It's not a new controversy. Ancient Egyptians and Indians had theories of evolution, of the whole universe evolving from an egg. Empedocles, the Greek philosopher in the 5th century, had a view of everything arising by generation out of the natural processes of the world, so that we're not facing something that hasn't been with us for a long time. But the real turning point in the history of this topic came in 1859 when Darwin published Origin of Species. In this book in 1859, for the first time, someone offered a plausible explanation as to how the whole theory of evolution could work. Reading Malthus on the role of human population, Darwin found the clue for the theory by which he could interpret all of the data he had seen on his famous voyage of the Beagle, which he had been working on for 5 years since 1832. And Darwin said, being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence which everywhere goes on, from long-continued observation of habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones would tend to be destroyed. And on the basis of that observation of the small changes he had seen in the finches' beaks, for example, and by the population theory of Malthus, Darwin invented the theory of natural selection, that in the struggle for existence, there is the survival of the fittest, and it tends to produce favorable changes that are passed on from generation to generation, and all of the species originate naturally. Might be well for us to know a little bit about Charles Darwin himself. One of the best books on this topic was produced recently by an evangelical Christian, published by Cambridge, James Moore, The Post-Darwinian Controversy. In it, he says this: born into a family noted for its liberality in politics and religion, Darwin was christened in the Church of England and sent to a school conducted by the Unitarian minister whose chapel his mother attended. In 1828, after an abortive attempt at Edinburgh to follow his father in the medical profession, he entered the University of Cambridge, where his father had decided he should prepare for the ministry. The thought of being a country clergyman was not attractive, and soon, with the aid of Pearson's exposition of the Creed and Samuel Sumner's evidence of Christianity derived from its nature and reception, Darwin abandoned whatever were his scruples about professing belief in all the doctrines of the church. And during this time, Darwin engaged as a naturalist in the study of species. And in his famous trip on the Beagle, Darwin concluded that the explanation that was given, that God directly created these things, was inadequate. And he began to take a naturalistic interpretation of the data. And Darwin came up with the understanding that natural law can explain everything. In this famous quote, he says, "The explanation of types of structure and classes as resulting from the will of the deity to create animals on certain plans is no explanation. It has not the character of a physical law and is therefore utterly useless. It foretells nothing because we know nothing of the will of the deity, how it acts, and whether constant or inconstant like that of man." Darwin said you cannot explain anything by saying God created, but if there is a natural law like the law of natural selection, you can explain it. Darwin was influenced by an atheist named Auguste Comte, who is the father of modern positivism, or otherwise known as scientism. A similar idea, a grand idea, Darwin called it, has been expressed by the naturalist, and Darwin did not hesitate to accept the consequences of this theory. During the summer of 1838, when he opened the first of two notebooks on man, mind, and materialism, Darwin found the grand idea in the positive philosophy of Auguste Comte. Comte taught that each branch of knowledge passes through three theoretical stages. The first one, the theological or fictitious stage. then the metaphysical or abstract explanation, and finally the scientific explanation. And Darwin said we have finally reached the day when we no longer understand things by theological intervention in the world, but as Auguste Comte had said, by scientific explanation of the universe in which we live. In the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, they describe Darwin's pilgrimage from his earlier Christian beliefs to his agnosticism. Here's what they say. In his autobiography, he underwent a change from naive acceptance of Christian doctrine to reluctant agnosticism. In the 2 years following his return from the voyage of the Beagle, he was led to think much about religion. Doubts were engendered in his mind about the historical veracity of the Gospels, the occurrence of miracles, and the dogma of everlasting damnation of unbelievers, which Darwin called a damnable doctrine. By reflection on such matters, he gradually came to disbelieve in Christianity and wondered how anybody could wish it to be true. In The Origin of Species, Darwin accepted a vague theism or deism. The last line, he talked about the creator of the first form of life. But he was able to say at this time that he was not writing atheistically. However, later, in the end, he said, "The whole subject is beyond the scope of man's intellect. The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us, and I, for one, must be content to remain agnostic." So Darwin started in a Christian background, trained in Unitarian church setting, became deistic in his belief about the world, saying that God created the first life but the rest evolved, and finally concluded that he wasn't even sure there was a God. Now in 1860 and following, T.H. Huxley, who called himself Darwin's bulldog because Darwin was more modest in his claims and Huxley was more forthright, an apologist for evolution, Huxley took the doctrine of Darwin and he used it to fight Christians in an anti-God and anti-Bible tirade. He said, "I can see no reason for doubting that all our coordinate terms of nature, great progression from formless to the form, from the inorganic to the organic, from blind force to conscious intellect and will." Though Huxley denied that he was an atheist and called himself an agnostic, he used Darwin's thesis that you cannot find design in nature to argue against God and against the supernatural. About the same time, a philosopher named Herbert Spencer, who one morning was meditating on the waves on Sunday morning, and it occurred to him that the cosmic theory of evolution was true, that not only had everything evolved in the realm of plants and animals, but there was a cosmic evolution occurring. Darwin, in his book, The Descent of Man, referred to Spencer in these words. "Our great philosopher Herbert Spencer has recently explained his views on the moral sense." So Spencer developed evolution into a cosmic theory. Huxley used it to argue against Christianity. Spencer said, "The ultimate of ultimates is force. Matter and motion, as we know them, are differently conditioned manifestations of force. We have, then, no God but force." So the evolutionist of Darwin's day, and even the co-founder of natural selection, a man by the name of Wallace, took Darwin's principles and concluded that there was no need for God. That takes us to 1861, when the Civil War began, and 1862, Spencer published his first book, The First Principles. And in 1864 and following, Spencer published a series of books in which he elaborated this philosophy of cosmic atheism. 1870 to 1880, Spencer's philosophy grew in the United States. It became one of the most popular philosophies in the post-Civil War period in the United States. In 1871, Darwin wrote his second book, The Descent of Man. In the first book, The Origin of Species, 1859, he had talked about the origin of animal life, and he had withheld his growing belief that man, too, had evolved. But in 1871, Darwin published The Descent of Man and came to the conclusion that man, body, soul, and spirit, had evolved from lower forms of animal life. In 1874, Charles Hodge, the famous Princeton theologian, in many respects, along with Warfield and others, the father of modern fundamentalism, Charles Hodge wrote a book entitled, What is Darwinism? And in this book, on page 176 and 177, he says, we have thus arrived at the answer to our question. What is Darwinism? It is atheism. This does not mean, as before said, that Mr. Darwin himself and all who adopt his views are atheists, but it means that his theory is atheistic, that the exclusion of design from nature is, as Dr. Gray says, tantamount to atheism. So that Hodge warned American Christians that the implications of Darwin's theory were directly atheistic. Not all Christians responded this way. There were a number of Christians, including Asa Gray, a Calvinist, and George Wright, who in the early Bibsack between 1875 and 1880 wrote articles in defense of Darwinism, saying that Christians should look at it as a biological and scientific theory, and it could possibly be God's mode of creation of the universe. Asa Gray reviewed Hodge's book in 1874 and disagreed with Charles Hodge's analysis that Darwinism was atheism, and a friendship occurred between George Wright and Asa Gray, in which in the next years they tried to make Darwinism palatable to American Christians and show how it was compatible with God's great purpose for the evolving of the animal life. However, it became readily apparent that others were not perceiving it this way. Joseph Wellhausen in 1878 took one of Darwin's ideas that not only had man evolved and man's concept of God had evolved as well, and he developed it into a theory of higher criticism in which he suggested that the Old Testament gives us an evolutionary picture of God. That first it started out as polytheism and then went to henotheism and finally developed into monotheism, but the very concept of God evolved. By this time it was becoming readily apparent to American Christians that Darwinism was a militant, anti-Christian, anti-biblical point of view. Despite that, in 1886, Joseph Van Dyke wrote a book entitled Theism and Evolution, in which Charles Hodge's son, A.A. Hodge, wrote the introduction, in which they still made a plea that there was scientific value to Darwinism, that it had an observational basis, and that one should not throw out the baby with the bathwater. It was favorable to biological evolution, while it warned against the philosophy and the religion of evolution. In 1889, A.E. Wallace, the co-founder of natural selection with Darwin, spelled out his view of religious evolution, in which the evolutionary process became God, in which he concluded that the evolutionary process itself should be the equivalent of God in the minds of people. Darwin had said this in his book. He said, the highest form of religion, the grand idea of God, hating sin and loving righteousness, was unknown during primitive times. Man evolved and the concept of God evolved along with man. Chapter 5 of The Descent of Man, Darwin entitles it, On the Development of the Intellectual and Moral Faculties During Primeval and Civilized Time. Man's religion evolved and man's ethics evolved too. About this time, a philosopher named Friedrich Nietzsche was developing his particular atheistic philosophy. He became aware of Charles Darwin, and Nietzsche said in his book, The Genealogy of Morals, if Darwinism is accepted, it will turn moral principles upside down. Nietzsche had also declared that God is dead, and that when God died, all absolutes died with God. Someone said Nietzsche wrote, God is dead, sign Nietzsche, and someone put under it, Nietzsche is dead, sign God. But at the same time, Nietzsche was drawing the relativistic and atheistic implications of Darwin's theory, as Darwin himself had indicated that morals had developed as well as man and man's concept of God. This leads us to 1892, when this first broke out in an ecclesiastical way, a man by the name of C.A. Briggs denied the inspiration of the Bible. He said the Bible is not completely inspired. It is inspired only on spiritual and moral matters, but not on scientific matters. This, of course, precipitated a great controversy, the fundamentalist liberalism controversy at the old Princeton University. And C.A. Briggs was defrocked of his credentials in the Presbyterian ministry because of teaching this particular heresy. It's of interest to note that in 1950s and 60s in the United States, and continuing today, we have the same debate that is occurring, the so-called inerrancy debate. It really goes back to 1889. And B.B. Warfield and Charles Hodge wrote in several books an attack upon this view, and B.B. Warfield entitled it Limited Inspiration. Is the Bible limited in its inspiration to only spiritual matters, or does it cover matters of science as well? H.D. MacDonald, in an excellent book on the history of theories of revelation, published by Baker several years ago, pointed out that the theory of denying the inerrancy of Scripture did not arise until after 1860. It was a direct influence of Darwin, who said that God adapted himself to the evolutionary process, and so the documents of the Bible were produced as the body of man was produced from lower forms of animal life, and then God breathed into it. So they adopted a theistic evolutionary model for explaining evolution, and then became deniers of the traditional doctrine of the inspiration of the Bible. In 1893, a man named Ernst Haeckel, a German atheist, had taken Darwin's views and developed a view which he called monism as connecting religion and science. It was an anti-God, anti-Bible movement that highly influenced the whole of the German intelligentsia, and it became the foundation for much of modern criticism against the Bible and against God. In 1894, then, B.B. Warfield wrote his book, Limited Inspiration, attacking this modernism that had taken Darwin and applied it to God and morals and applied it to the Bible. Continuing in their religious development, in 1896, T.H. Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, wrote a particular tract called Evolution and Ethics, in which he was fighting the idea that there had to be an evolutionary ethic because there was an evolution of man. It was inevitable, however, that this would be concluded as Nietzsche did in his book, The Genealogy of Morals. As a result of this, in America, there became a solidification of churches known as fundamentalists. In 1910, the Northern Presbyterians published five fundamentals. Five fundamental beliefs that they had that included the inspiration of the Bible and the deity of Christ and the substitutionary atonement. In 1910 to 1915, there was a publication called The Fundamentals, which was anti-religious Darwinism. In this book, however, three people who wrote, James Orr, B.B. Warfield, and George Wright, all believed in a form of theistic evolution. So at this time, as late as 1910 to 1915, the early fundamentalists had not ruled out evolution entirely as a possible biological explanation. They were vehemently opposed to making it a religion, to saying you can prove there is no God with it or that miracles do not occur, but they were not opposed to a long earth. They were not opposed to explaining the geological column by some sort of uniformitarianism against catastrophism, and they were not opposed to allowing a certain form of biological evolution. Again, I repeat, James Orr, B.B. Warfield, and George Wright all wrote articles, some of them on the topic of evolution, in the classic work called The Fundamentals, which is the book from which modern fundamentalism takes its source. In 1917, following this, General Allenby entered Jerusalem. This was a significant move because it had been predicted by many students of prophecy that the Jews were going to return to the land of Palestine, and this event had tremendous public and prophetic significance in America. In 1918, the war ended, In 1919, the World Christian Fundamentalist Association was formed. After this, a man by the name of B.B. Riley, a very famous fundamentalist preacher from Minneapolis, Minnesota, had taken a trip to Germany, and he had seen the atrocities that had occurred in Europe as a result of the German domination and the German wars that had been precipitated. This was attributed to the works of Charles Darwin because of the evolutionary implications of what had occurred in Germany and the godlessness that had arisen. It was concluded that the World War was directly a result of this and the barbarism that occurred, and so fundamentalism gained a new enemy. In 1920, the fundamentalist term was coined by a man named C.L. Laws. The term fundamentalism was used for the first time as a term. In 1921, William Jennings Bryan adopted an anti-evolutionary campaign, and he had lost out for the presidency, and he became the popular champion of Americans who by this time were sure that Darwin's philosophy was anti-God, anti-Christian, and anti-Bible. Unfortunately, the cause was not defended by scientists or by knowledgeable people, by and large. In fact, even a number of religious bigots got on the bandwagon, including the KKK and others who were against Darwinism. And the whole cause of fundamentalism came into disrepute when, in 1925, at the famous Scopes trial, William Jennings Bryan faced Clarence Darrow, the ACLU lawyer, over the question of whether a law in the state of Tennessee as to whether creation or evolution could be taught in the public schools was violated by a young teacher named John Scopes. Now, the ACLU had advertised for somebody to deliberately disobey this law. As it turns out, John Scopes apparently didn't even teach evolution, but he said he did, or it was said that he did, and he was taken to court, and he was fined $100 for teaching evolution, and all of the newspapers from all over the world knew of the famous fundamentalist bigots who didn't want evolution taught, who wanted only the biblical view of creation to be taught in the public schools. And by and large, that was the turning point in America against creationism and for evolution. And though we won legally in 1925, we lost socially and we lost in the media. And from that time to this, it's been very difficult to convince anyone that the creation-evolution controversy is anything but a religion versus science movement. I might point out, however, that in 1924, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, in which he described in that book that Darwin's theory of evolution was the basis for the superiority of the Aryan race. And it became the basis for his anti-Semitism, and Darwin was used by Hitler in order to prove that survival of the fittest applies to the races as well as it does to the species. Following the Scopes trial, 1926 and following, a number of states in reaction against evolution passed laws forbidding the teaching of evolution. In fact, the last of these laws was repealed only as late as 1968 in the famous Epperson case in Arkansas. So from 1926 to 1968, many of the southern states still had laws forbidding the teaching of evolution. The Supreme Court ruled that it is legal to teach evolution. It ruled that it is illegal to outlaw the teaching of evolution in the schools, although it never ruled on the teaching of creation. In 1933, the humanists wrote a manifesto. In this manifesto, they said, "It is an urgent necessity that we establish a religion of humanism." Now, the reason for that was, among other things, that the American Constitution had given religious liberties by the First Amendment. And the religious liberties by the First Amendment were not enjoyed by people who did not believe in God, because, of course, our country was built on the inalienable rights of the Creator, and if you didn't believe in the Creator, you weren't religious. During a series of court decisions from starting really in 1947, but particularly 1961 through 1968, the courts ruled that humanism is a religion. 1961, the famous Torcaso versus Watkins case ruled that among the religions in the United States that are recognized that do not believe in God are Buddhism, Taoism, and secular humanism. So the 1933 Humanist Manifesto said, we must establish the religion of humanism in order to get our rights under the Constitution of the United States. This religion of humanism defined itself of having four central tenets. No God is needed, no creation occurred, everything is to be explained naturalistically, and man chooses his own values. Those four tenets are exactly the tenets, by implication and directly, that were established on January 5th, 1981 by Judge William Overton in Arkansas as the only tenets that can be taught in a science class in the state of Arkansas. So in effect, we have come from 1776, a country built on God, creation, the supernatural, and unalienable rights, absolute moral principles, four tenets of the traditional theistic religion, to the four tenets of humanistic religion, no God, no creation, no supernaturalism, and man must choose his own values. For almost a generation following the controversy of 1925, fundamentalists separated and by and large did not penetrate the intellectual and the higher academic realms of our society. As a result of that, we did not have trained scientists to answer the evolutionists, and we resorted strictly to religious and biblical and theological arguments. However, after the Second World War, due to the influence of Carl Henry and men like Wilbur Smith, there became an increased emphasis on evangelicals getting educated, going to school, penetrating the areas of science and culture. And so for a generation now, evangelicals have received PhDs in virtually every area of science and sociology and history and philosophy and the humanities. And something interesting has happened. As a result of that, there is arising again a new controversy on an educated, intellectual, scientific level between creation and evolution. And I'd like to draw a few conclusions from what we have been discussing. First of all, the early fundamentalists saw Darwin in two ways. Men like Orr, Wright, and Gray saw him as a possibility of explaining how God created. Other people like Hodge said, be careful, it's anti-design, and implicitly it's anti-God. The earliest fundamentalists saw that the theory of evolution could be understood in those two ways. The earliest evolutionists saw that it eliminated the need for God. Some became agnostic, like Darwin and Huxley. Others became atheist, like Haeckel. Some became pantheist, like Spencer and Wallace. At best, they were deist, naturalist. The one thing they all had in common is all of the world should be understood by natural principles and by no supernatural intervention. Later, many used evolution to justify strange things outside of the realm of biology. They became naturalistic philosophers, as Spencer and Haeckel. They used it for higher criticism, as did Wellhausen. They used it for ethical relativism, as did Nietzsche. They used it for Nazism and anti-Semitism, as did Hitler. And in view of this second reaction and use of the evolutionists themselves of Darwin's theory, fundamentalists overreacted against the theory of evolution, and it led to the famous Scopes trial, in which extremists like the KKK, uneducated people in the sciences like William Jennings Bryan, who was made a fool of by Clarence Darrow at the trial, got involved, and the whole controversy became known as a religion, a bigoted religion versus science. In fact, let me give you two quotes that I think are worthy of application to today's situation that come from the Scopes trial. Clarence Darrow, ACLU lawyer, 1925, at the Scopes trial. Quote, it is bigotry for public schools to teach only one theory of origins. End quote. 56 years later, December 7th through 17th, I sat through 2 weeks of ACLU bigotry, in which the ACLU lawyers said, in effect, it is bigotry to teach two theories of origin. Now I declare to you that any group that can argue that it's bigotry to teach only one theory when theirs isn't being taught, and it is bigotry to teach two theories when theirs is being taught, are themselves the bigots. And I have concluded that the ACLU should be called the Anti-Civil Liberties Union. The second thing that I'd like you to note from the Scopes trial is a quote by John Scopes himself, the man who was fined $100 for teaching evolution. Quote, "If you limit a teacher to only one side of anything, the whole country will eventually have only one thought, be one individual." And I would like to suggest that the controversy that exists today needs to resurrect John Scopes and Clarence Darrow. And we need to say, if the religious people of 1925 were bigots wanting to teach Genesis and religion and excluding a scientific theory from the public schools, then what is it today that we have in the religion of humanism championed by the ACLU that says the only point of view you can teach in a country that was founded on God, creation, the supernatural, and absolute moral principles, that the only thing that can be taught is no God, no supernaturalism, no creation, and man chooses his own values? Something's happened to America in the last 51, 56, or 57 years, and it's that you and I have lost our rights under the First Amendment. Our country is being swept by a tide of humanism, and we are paying the bitter price for a generation of isolation. We are paying the bitter price for an overreaction against the scientific theory. We should have learned from the Roman Catholic Church down through the years a lesson, and the lesson is this: you do not squelch heresy by condemnation, but by refutation. We should have engaged on an intellectual and scientific basis. Thank God, the beginning in 1963 at the founding of the Creation Research Society and in the post-World War period when many Christians got credentials in science, we have mustered together an army of Christian scientists who can now say on a scientific level, point for point, argument for argument, there is no basis for the theory of evolution, surely no more basis than there is for the theory of creation. And tomorrow, I would like to talk to you about the scientific implications of the theory of evolution. With this history in mind, what is the scientific basis for evolution and creation? And can we engage today as evangelical Christians on a philosophical, scientific basis and restore, as it were, the credibility of Christianity in the world whose media has distorted it since the Scopes trial as a bunch of religious bigots, and in which we have a situation today where the very reverse is true, that it is not religious bigotry on our part, but it is reversed religious bigotry when the religious humanists are excluding the possibility of the scientific evidence for creation to be presented in the public schools. I say with Clarence Darrow, it's bigotry for public schools to teach only one theory of origin, and it doesn't matter whether the one theory is creation or evolution. It's bigotry to exclude one. If it was bigotry in 1925, it's bigotry in 1982, and you and I must get involved in this momentous controversy that is going on today, lest we lose the last remnants of academic freedom and religious liberty that we have in the United States. Thank you.